This is Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. If you've seen Woody Allen's film Zelig, you'll know the main character is a man who was present at some key moments in history. He rubs shoulders with everyone from Charlie Chaplin to Hitler. The person at the centre of our next story is probably his closest real-life equivalent. Ethel May Punchin was born towards the end of the 19th century, and she lived to the ripe old age of 106. And you're about to hear the life of Miss Punchin, or Monty to her friends, was as unconventional as it was long. Lucy Bracey uncovers Monty's story in A Singular Life.
It's very difficult at my age, 106. It's difficult for others younger than that to think what to ask you or what to say to you because they have never done it before.
One of the first things that struck you when you met Monty, because she was a powerful personality, but in a very small body. So she was absolutely tiny. And when people get old, they either get fat or thin. And Monty had got very thin. So she was very small with absolutely shining white hair.
I think her attitude, you know, that she was a seeker and that she... But she was very smart in that she was able to walk that fine line of respectability.
Monty was very proper in her manner, but also quite wild in other aspects. So she was an interesting combination of different facets.
Ethel May Punchin, Monty to her friends, was born in 1882 in Ballarat, Victoria. I first came across her while working on a community history project in Melbourne, and I was immediately drawn to this fascinating woman. Monty lived to be 106 years old, and in that time was present at two international exhibitions, 1888 and 1988, witnessed Federation and Australian women getting the vote. She lived through two world wars and the advent of space travel.
I've got a treat in store for you, I want you all to know. We're going back many years to the days of long ago.
Monty grew up in a conservative middle-class family. Her father encouraged her to take up teaching, which became a useful foundation for the rest of her life. Here's Monty in one of the many interviews she recorded during her lifetime, talking to historian Patsy Adam-Smith, in 1977.
I always wanted to have a theatrical career. See, my father was very much against it. In those days, it was a terribly immoral profession, and nobody was any good at all if it was connected with the theatre. So I was almost deprived of seeing a theatre. But he didn't mind church functions or amateur shows, you know, but paid professionals, no, it was anathema. But because of that, I'm very grateful to him, because it did take me into other walks of life, which I couldn't have entered if I hadn't had that education and training.
She wanted to be an actress, really, really strongly. But of course, at the turn of the century, only dodgy women were on the stage. That's why she, as a teacher, she became the teacher for the J.T. Williamson's Junior Theatre. So that was clever, I always thought, that she did that, because she could fulfil the kind of respectability requirement, but she also lived in the atmosphere of the theatre.
Friend Nancy Peck, who filmed a biographical interview with Monty in 1989.
She didn't compromise often, but if you take, for example, the fact that when she wanted to go into the theatre and her parents said no, she didn't just run off and join the theatre. She found a way around that. So she was somebody who didn't want to offend, and so was careful within her own achieving of what she wanted to achieve to do that within a way that wouldn't be upsetting to other people.
Another friend of Monty's, Helen Palsacker.
My father very strongly objected to my being connected with the theatre in any way, if it was professional. He didn't mind a bit in amateur way, In fact, he rather encouraged it. If I were to recite anywhere, he was quite proud of it, especially if it was Shakespeare. But he couldn't bear to think of me going on to professional stage. And so I took the name of Montagu. And Miss Brennan, her ballet mistress, who travelled with us, wonderful woman she was too, she began to call me Monty, and the children began to call me Miss Montagu, and there it was. I was stuck with it. It's proved a very valuable name ever since.
In 1905, Monty travelled with J.C. Williamson's Juvenile Opera Company as their teacher. When World War I broke out, she joined an amateur theatre company with Arthur Coppin, son of Australian theatre legend George Coppin, raising funds for the war effort. In the early 1920s, when radio was just taking off, Monty became one of the first voices on the airwaves.
I had a great deal of experience with radio. I was in it in the earliest of days, and Mr. Lloyd heard me. Mr. Lloyd was manager of Buckley & Nunn, and he sent for me, asked me to come and see him. And he proposed two sessions a week on fashion for them. So I did, and the nom de plume of Au fait of Buckley & Nunn.
She was very fashionable herself, even when she was 101. She was very smart dresser and quite unconventional within a conventional fashion. So she wore a lot of red, for example, which particularly when we're talking back then was less common for older people to dare to go out into those sort of colours. She had quite a lot of Japanese outfits, so she certainly was a force to reckon with when you met her. And that, again, was evident in her early life when she'd done fashion radio programs.
When I came back from my first trip to Japan, I was always fond of China. China was my first love. And I was so ashamed of seeing the little kiddies in Japan with their mothers, the tiny little ones, and when I speak to them, you know, say hello, they'd say hello in English, and then they'd say bye-bye. And here was I, a teacher, and I didn't know one word of their language. I thought, that's terrible. So when I went back, I started in little Bourke Street, went to the Tsinghua, that's the Chinese school, to learn Chinese. And I was getting along very nicely. I even made a little speech, 4-minute speech in Chinese at the Joss House one night. They had a tea meeting or something. And then Japanese was being put on from 3LO. There was a Mr. Inagaki and a Mr. Trainor, and they were giving lessons, and I listened in. And at the end of the year, I sat for the little exam and passed it very easily. So then I decided I'd go to the university. And I went to Melbourne University, and I got through, got the degree, they call it. They don't give you a certificate, but you get that degree in passing. I did it in 4 years instead of five. I was like a tiger for it. I couldn't leave it alone.
Men and women of Australia, we are at war with Japan.
I offered my services as a nursing aide at the Southern Command, and there they thought, well, that was too, it was rather wasted becoming a nursing aide, and that I could do better with by interpreting. So I had charge of the non-English speaking Japanese people at the Tatura, and there I stayed with some very distinguished people, and there were doctors, and there were judges, some very gifted people too.
Monty's time as a guard at Tatura internment camp during World War II was just one chapter in a lifelong interest in all things Japanese. It began with her first visit to the country in 1929. She returned many times, including a teaching stint in Tokyo in 1963 when she was 81 years old. Her long association with Japan and its people was officially recognised in 1985 when she was appointed the Japanese Order of the Sacred Treasure.
She was a very fine intellect, and she wasn't interested in hearing fiction. She wanted people to read from new discoveries and science because she was very, very definite about the fact that she had plenty of fiction already in her own memory. That's why when I made the film, why I opened with her from memory doing, 7 minutes of, you know, just without notes, straight from Nicholas Nickleby.
Nicholas, having duly arrived at the inn, looked into the coffee room in search of Mr. Squeers. He found that learned gentleman sitting at breakfast with the 5 little boys ranged in a row on the opposite seat. Mr. Squeers had before him a roast beef, a plate of hot toast, and a pot of coffee.
At the point that I met Monty, her eyesight was failing. She had cataracts over her eyes, and she would like people to read to her so that she could keep information coming in.
She used to choose what we read,
but they had to read in a particular way. So they had to be good readers. She didn't like people who didn't pronounce their words properly, so she was quite proper on that.
And because of her diction is so spectacular, you know, and used to frighten the life out of all of us, you found yourself kind of like merely watching how you said things, you know.
Is that 2 pennyworth of milk? Waiter, said Squeers, peering into a large blue mug and slanting it gently so as to get an accurate view of the exact quantity. That's 2 pennyworth, sir, replied the waiter. What a rare article milk is in London, said Mr. Squeers with a sigh. Each day now, I have to learn to be patient, and it's quite an art, I can tell you. Waiting, waiting, waiting for the hours to go by. That's the worst part of it. If I could only be doing something, it would be marvellous, because I feel capable in every way. But there's nothing at my age that I could do regularly. I could study, but I can't read to study. If I could only read, I would be right.
Monty never married, but she was surrounded by friendship and love all her life.
Once, when women were not married, they were looked upon as being on the shelf and somewhat inferior, and people were sorry for them. And what a pity so-and-so isn't married, and that sort of remark went on.
A friend of mine, Graham, a gay male friend, had met Monty at a senior's occasion, and it had occurred to him that Monty seemed very different to the others. And so he had asked her, Monty, were you ever married? And she said, oh, I wouldn't have been that stupid.
But gradually, and now particularly, they're positively glad, some of them, that they are not pressured into being married. They prefer to be single, on their own, and individuals, people, not just appendages.
When Monty talks on the film that Nancy made and reading through her biography, she doesn't make any mention of her personal life, her love life, or even really any sort of close friendships or relationships she had.
Yes, and I think that's also where, in looking at her age and her upbringing, that in certain periods of time, it was just not something that you talked about. Because on a personal level, she didn't seem to be torn or anything like that. She was quite happy to chat. But I didn't think that, she felt that that was something that you discussed in public.
Oh, absolutely. The thing about Monty is that it wasn't as though she was secretive. I think people who knew, knew. And she also used to go to the Laird and be sat up on the bar, and the boys would buy her drinks, and, you know, she was a bit of a star among the lads.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night.
Well, when I was younger, I felt a great attraction to women always, much more so than men. Women meant quite a lot to me. Men were just men, and that was all.
But I do remember her excitement at finding out that there was a word that actually described her, because she'd never heard the word lesbian until she was like 100, you know.
Goodbye and part, I'll always keep you in my heart with me, Lily Marley.
The labelling was really a gay liberation idea that had sort of bypassed Monty. So I think the idea of labels for Monty was fairly irrelevant, but it certainly didn't mean that she didn't have the desires. You know, she had good friendships with men, but I think very little attraction at all to men. So she it wasn't that she was somewhere in the middle and needed to label herself. That was just who she was, but it wasn't something that she talked about. So I think there needs to be a bit of care in making assumptions, because she didn't use labels that made her desires less. She was very naughty and very flirty.
I'm quite happy and satisfied to have lovable, just loving friends that put me first. I must say that. I like to be put first.
Oh yes, she was very proper. And because I come from a kind of radical feminist, gay, whatever background, she was very clear that we differed about the whole notion of why do you need to make a fuss.
It's you, Lily Marlene.
Well, I think by the time I knew her, whenever she went out, she was the centre of attention, because she did become very well known in the gay and lesbian scene, and it wasn't very easy to hide the fact that you were the only 100 and, well, as went on, 101, 102, 103, 104, 105-year-old that was there in the gay bar. And she definitely did revel in everybody coming and paying attention to her.
I'm here to have a look through Monty's scrapbooks. As well as interviews and an autobiography, Monty left behind two scrapbooks of newspaper clippings and articles, now held at the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, ALGA, in Melbourne. Guiding me through Monty's scrapbooks is ALGA historian Graham Willett.
And bits and pieces of it are highlighted, sort of in red, so it looks like she's gone through and marked particularly interesting points.
Monty leaves no clues as to the intention behind her scrapbook collection. To anyone who didn't know her, their contents paint a picture of a very different woman from the one who made them.
I think that's really true, that she was protective of not turning into like a caricature. I'd known some of the photos, and there's great photos, but she used to poo-poo them, you know.
I enjoyed every minute of the period in which I can hear of women being caught up in politics and in affairs of the nation and in the happenings of the world, in adventures, women going round the world solo and following their own desires and wishes.
So it's this stuff about the non-conforming women, or women who don't meet the usual standards of femininity. You know, here's two women on a 1,000-mile hike, a Finnish girl and a woman from South Australia, leaving the Adelaide post office yesterday at the start of their 1,000-mile hike to Sydney by way of Melbourne. One of the girls carries a revolver, and they intend to try to cover an average of 30 miles a day on their long trip. And kind of, it's sort of in the absence of any sort of women's movement that you might join up to, a particular kind of strong-willed woman would decide, well, I'm just going to live differently. That's one of those things about this scrapbook. It reminds you just how far we've come, but also that a lot of this stuff was there already. You know, there have always been women who haven't conformed, who kind of aim for academic achievement or strive to engage in sports or to drive motor cars and things.
I think women have become very much more powerful and worthwhile in the last 10 years. In fact, it seems as if, to me, as if they'd always been. Now, have much more to say than I did when I was a girl.
So she wasn't a bang and drum kind of radical. She was just always very clever at, if she couldn't do A to B of what she wanted, she always found a C.
Yes, she was very brave, and in a sense it was braver because she was overcoming fears and prejudices. But she wasn't somebody who didn't care at all about what people thought or worried about things. She was someone who did things in spite of those doubts and fears.
I've been afraid of everything. I'm a most nervous person, a very, very nervous person. But I have to struggle very often not to be afraid, constantly, even in the car, in driving along, I have to constantly keep my mind on the thought, now don't be afraid, the axles might be loose, but don't be afraid. The car might go down suddenly on one wheel, but don't be afraid, because you won't benefit by it. Car will just tip over and that'll be the end of it, but don't be afraid.
She didn't like talking about her age, so you were certainly aware of the fact that she was older. And she would muddle up the two wars, for example. She'd forget sometimes when she was talking to you that perhaps you hadn't lived through the First World War as well. So in that sense, yes, but she was certainly exceptionally alive in her spirit.
Because it's very hard to get a concept when you're sitting, talking and meeting with a person who is active-brained, 106. I used to do, to be naughty, I used to go around to various people who'd met her at various things and say, how old do you reckon she is? Most people thought she was in her 80s and she was actually, had turned 100.
So it was only when she was 106 and in the last year of her life that, for example, Monty started talking about death. Prior to that, if anybody introduced it into the topic, Monty wouldn't follow through with it. She wasn't interested in it. But in that last year, it was as if she was preparing herself for death and started talking about death and how this would be the next step in the journey. So, yeah, there was an element of denial in her ability to keep living.
Death, I just don't know anything. I've never died, you see. If I could die once, I would know. But I cannot, and no one can. They must just be content with going. Just dream on what will come to them. Just dream about it. Think about it. Ponder on it. And welcome it. as a new experience, a marvellous experience. It must be something great, because life is so great. The death can't be less.
Monty died on the 4th of April, 1989, at 106 years old. She achieved many things during her lifetime, but the legacy she leaves behind is not what she did, but how she did it. It's her philosophy on living and her decision to live differently that makes Monty's life so remarkable.
A Singular Life, the story of Monty Punchin, was presented and produced by Lucy Bracey, with technical production from Melissa May. Next week, the strange and tragic story of the first two men hanged in Melbourne. That's Hindsight next Sunday here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Talk to you then.
Did you know that right underneath the heart of Sydney's CBD, there's a lake? It's over a kilometre long and 6 metres deep in parts, right next to the City Circle railway line in an unfinished tunnel. Rumour has it that the army sends troops down there to train in complete darkness.
Hello.
And there's a huge albino eel which pops up when you least expect it. Off track, anytime on the RN website.